Setting coordinates. Outlaw located.
Hi, I'm Ryan McCarthy, and welcome to The Stolen Goods. This podcast is all about outlaws, bandits, and scourges of the seven seas. Every week, we're going to take a look at a different one of these characters and learn about them. We'll shine the spotlight on some of the most infamous bandits, outlaws, and pirates in history, and even dig deeper to learn about some that maybe you haven't heard of before. I am not a historian, nor do I claim to be an expert on the topic. I'm just a guy who thinks this type of stuff is rad and wants to learn more about it. So grab your bow and arrow, six-shooter, and bag of blue, and join me as we walk the plank and plunge into the lawless world of banditry and swashbucklery. Is that a word? Together. All right, and welcome to the Christmas special of The Stolen Goods. My name is Ryan McCarthy. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm releasing this on Sunday, Christmas Day. I'm not doing this on Christmas Day. That would be crazy. I'm spending time with my family on Christmas Day, but I wanted to make sure to crank this out on Christmas, because doing a Christmas special on the 26th is too late. It's too late, and everybody's like, Christmas is over, you know. So this is Sunday, and Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, since that's still going on right now, and Happy Kwanzaa, that'll start tomorrow, for everybody who's celebrating whatever you're celebrating. And so today, I dug into the archives of the world and just looking for something that had some sort of Christmas, theme to it, and man, did I find one. So today, we're looking at the Santa Claus bank robbery of 1927 in Cisco, Texas. Without further ado, let's get this Christmas extravaganza started, and let's jump into the time machine, and let's head back there right now. So here we are in the year 1927. It's been an exciting year so far. On January 7th, the Harlem Globetrotters said hello to the world as they played their first game against the Hinckley Merchants and lost 43-34. On May 20th, Charles Lindbergh made the first transatlantic flight from New York to Paris in his airplane, the Spirit of St. Louis, earning him the nickname Plucky Lindy for his positive can-do attitude. The name got changed to Lucky Lindy because it sounded better in the song that they wrote for him. On September 30th, Babe Ruth hit his 60th home run, a record that stood for 34 years, almost to the day, until Roger Maris hit 61 home runs on October 1st, 1961. And in Texas, bank robberies were running rampant, with 3 to 4 banks being robbed per day. And it was so bad that the Texas Bankers Association was offering up a $5,000 reward for anyone who shot and killed a bank robber. At the end of this wild and wacky year, on Friday, December 23rd, in Cisco, Texas, a man in a Santa Claus suit was walking down Avenue D at noon, chatting with passersby and rustling the hair of star-struck children who were seeing jolly old Saint Nick in person. But this man's goal wasn't to spread the holiday cheer to everyone in town. His goal was to rob the First National Bank of Cisco. His name was Marshall Ratliff, a 24-year-old man from Cisco, Texas, who had spent time in Huntsville Penitentiary for a previous robbery in Valera, Texas in 1926 with his brother, Lee Ratliff. The judge had given him 20 years, but was pardoned by Texas Governor Marion A. Ferguson after only 1 year. Marshall and his brother Lee bounced around for a little while, working odd jobs like working on an oil field in Kansas, and quickly concluded that hard work wasn't their thing. So they decided to go back into the bank robbery game and started making plans to rob the First National Bank back in their hometown of Cisco, Texas. Unfortunately, shortly after starting to devise the plan for the heist, Lee went and got himself arrested for another bank robbery, so he was out. Fortunately, Marshall had met a few men on the inside at Huntsville who were out now and would be perfect for this. Henry Helms, who was 31, and Robert Hill, 21 years old. They also hired a man who was good at cracking safes. But that guy got the flu a few days before the robbery, so instead they recruited Lewis Davis. He was a family man and down on his luck and could use the extra cash and had some experience with safes. The trick was, however, how are they going to pull this heist off without Marshall getting recognized? Cisco was his hometown, and he knew everyone. Then the idea struck one of them to borrow the Santa suit that Midge Tellett, the lady who owned the boarding house that they were staying at, had made for her husband. Mrs. Tellett later said in an interview that they were very nice and polite, and she never suspected that they were bank robbers. So once they had the Santa suit, they felt confident enough to strike, and on December 23rd, they stole a car in Wichita Falls, Texas, about 10 miles south of the Oklahoma border, and drove about 120 miles south to Cisco, Texas, arriving shortly before noon. They dropped Marshall off, dressed in the Santa suit, a couple blocks down the street from the bank, and the rest of the bank robbers drove the car up to the bank and parked it in the alley on the side of the bank, which was located at the corner of West 8th Street and Avenue D, aka US Highway 183. So here we are, back to where we started, with Marshall walking down Avenue D, saying hi to people and recklessly granting the wishes of children who came up to him and telling him what they wanted for Christmas. Like, years later, a man named Bill Latch, brother of Lila Latch of the Lila Latch Lloyd Museum, which is currently at the Old Town Hall in Cisco, said in an interview that he was there that day shopping with Lila. And he went up to Santa and told him that he wanted the football in the nearby window. And Marshall was like, "You got it, kid." And I find this absolutely hilarious because when I was 19, for extra money, I played one of the many Santa Clauses at the Winter Wonderland exhibit at the G. Fox building in Hartford. And parents would bring their children in and they would sit on my lap and the kids would be like, "I want a pony," or I want a puppy. And the parents would be behind them like waving their hands and mouthing the word, "No, no," because I couldn't promise them a pony or a puppy or anything like that. So I'd have to say something like, "Well, you know, Timmy, a puppy is a big responsibility. Maybe you'd like a Beanie Baby instead," or whatever else was cool back in like 1998. And it would have been so funny if after the parents were like, "No, no, don't do it," I looked at them and I looked back at the kid and I was like, "You know what, kid? You got it." Like, the parents would have been so pissed. Anyway, everything seems to be going great. Marshall Ratliff was walking down Avenue D, Santa Claus ended up. Nobody suspects it's him, and plans are going great. The only problem was that kids kept following him. In fact, they followed him right into the bank. So Marshall walked into the bank, and immediately the cashier, Alex Spears, was like, "Hey, Santa." But Santa walked right by him, and Spears looked confused at his friend Marion Olson, his friend who was home from Harvard University for the holidays, and again he was like, "Hi, Santa." Still nothing. While this is happening, across the street, Mrs. Blazingame and her daughter Frances saw Santa walk into the bank, and Frances begged her mom to go see him. So they headed across the street, and right after they walked into the door of the bank, the other three bandits burst into the bank with guns drawn, and one of them yelled, "Stick him up!" And everyone thought it was a big joke at first, until one of the bandits walked up to Jewel Poe, the bank teller, and said, "Stick him up, big boy, I mean it." And after that, with some quick thinking, Mrs. Blazingame grabbed her daughter and darted for the bookkeeping room and unlocked the door leading to the outside while the robbers told her to stop or they would shoot. But they clearly weren't ready to kill anyone, especially an unarmed woman and her child, so both of them escaped, and Mrs. Blazingame went running across the street to the police station screaming, "They're robbing the bank! They're holding up the First National!" So it was time to act fast. While the other three robbers covered the bank tellers, cashier, and customers, Ratliff went behind the counter with a potato sack that said Idaho Potatoes on it and told the teller, Mr. Poe, to fill it up. He then grabbed a .45 caliber Colt semi-automatic pistol from behind the counter. A lot of good that did. After a little bit, he told Poe that that was enough, and he took the sack back. It was filled with $12,000 in cash and $150,000 in securities like bonds and banknotes. Now that the bank robbery was done, making their getaway was going to be a completely different story. By this point, the police had arrived, led by Sheriff G.E. Bit Bedford, along with his two deputy officers, R.T. Reddies and George Carmichael. Bedford instructed Reddies and Carmichael to cover the rear of the bank by the alleyway while Bedford covered the front. According to eyewitness Boyce House, who happened to also be a journalist and wrote the definitive newspaper article on this bank robbery, Bedford was a giant of a man and a veteran peace officer. So feeling the squeeze, someone fired a shot out the window and one of the police fired back. Then Robert Hill fired two shots into the ceiling just to reinforce a point that they were armed. And in no time, a shootout worthy of an action movie erupted with cops shooting at the robbers and the robbers shooting at the cops. And pretty soon, citizens that were carrying joined the fight and people that were unarmed ran to the hardware store, which was handing out guns like shoe rentals at the bowling alley. Soon the bank robbers started forcing the hostages to make their way to the side entrance by the alley where their getaway car was located. And once they opened the door to the alleyway, they were met by a hail of bullets from both directions. Bank robber Henry Helms was wielding dual pistols and would kick open the door and shoot one way and then the other before ducking back into the bank. The robbers forced the hostages out of the bank towards the car, using them as cover against the cops. Alex Spears was shot in the jaw and Marion Olson was shot in the leg. During this exchange of gunfire, both Sheriff Bedford and Deputy Carmichael were mortally wounded. Sheriff Bedford held on for a day and a half, but died early on Christmas Day. Carmichael held on for about a month, but he died in the hospital on January 17th in 1928. Bank robber Lewis Davis was also severely wounded in the shootout. Both Hill and Ratliff were wounded, but not as seriously. Most of the hostages got away, but two young girls did not. Both Ratliff and Helms grabbed 10-year-old Emma Mae Robertson and 12-year-old Laverne Comer and used them as human shields as they got into the car. Marion Olson was still with them, was forced to get to the back seat before Davis, but he quickly opened the door to the other side and got out of the car and ran off. Once they were in the car, they sped off with an angry mob of people shooting them from behind while also holding the two young girls hostage in the car. By the end of the shootout, there was an estimated minimum of 200 rounds of ammunition fired into the bank. As they made their way through town, they were throwing nails and tacks, whatever they had in the car, to pop the tires of their pursuers. They realized something very bad, though. They were running out of gas. According to some sources, it is said that they just didn't stop for gas before the bank robbery. But in the Boyce House article, it said that the fuel tank had been shot out during the getaway. So they needed to change cars soon. Now, mind you, they are not out of the woodwork yet. The angry mob is hot on their trail at this point. So they flagged down a car driven by 14-year-old Woodrow Wilson Harris and ordered him, his parents, and his grandmother to get out of the car, all while they are still in the middle of a firefight. Once the car was empty and the Harris family had run off, they put the wounded Davis in the back along with the money and were about to take off when they realized that the young boy Woodrow Wilson Harris had taken the keys with him when he ran off. So they had no choice but to get back into the original car and use whatever gas was left in it. So Ratliff, Helms, Hill, along with their two hostage girls, got back into the original car and took off. And in their haste, they had left the money in the car along with the wounded Lewis Davis. The money was returned to the bank. Unfortunately, Davis did not survive. He died that night at Fort Worth Hospital. And I say unfortunately when I speak of Davis. I don't have any sympathy for the other three bank robbers, but Davis didn't have a criminal record, and the only reason he joined the team was because he was struggling to make ends meet, and he was just trying to provide for his family. And another thing, Davis was hired onto the team because he had experience with safecracking. In all of the articles I read, nowhere did it say anything about him being used to crack a safe. So he didn't even need to be there. So he died for nothing. Stuff like that breaks my heart. And you can say that it was still his choice to be there and that he was still committing a crime, which is true. But it still breaks my heart. The other robbers had gotten back into the car and had driven a little while longer. And at one point, Hill asked if anyone was hurt, and Ratliff said that he had a bad chin. And he pulled down his fake beard, and one of the young girls had recognized him as Marshall Ratliff. They got to the end of the road and drove into the woods until they were met with brush that was so thick that they had no choice but to continue on foot, leaving the bullet-riddled car and the two girls behind unharmed. They continued on foot for a while trying to navigate the forest, all while dodging the search party that was after them. At one point, Hill had passed out from his wounds and they were hidden in the underbrush while the search party walked all around them, but they were never seen. The next morning, Hill and Helms snuck back into Cisco and stole a car and went back to pick up Ratliff. He had suffered a wound to his leg as well as his chin, and he couldn't walk very well. So they proceeded to drive on all these back roads, doubling back and do whatever they could do to avoid contact with the search party. By Sunday night, they had wrecked that car, and Helms made his way to a farmhouse owned by the Wileys. Helms sold Mr. Wiley this spiel about how they had crashed their car and his wife was sick and all this crap, and so Mr. Wiley agreed to loan him a car. And his nephew and his son, Carl Wiley, got into the car to accompany him. And as they were just about to leave, Mr. Wiley started to get suspicious about something, and he told the boys to get out of the car. His nephew was able to get out, but before Carl could, Helms pulled a gun and was like, "Not so fast, buddy." So he forced Carl to drive, and as they were driving away, Mr. Wiley ran back to the car with a shotgun and shot at them and ended up shooting Carl, his son, in the arm. Not exactly a dad of the year moment, but I can see how Mr. Wiley could have gotten caught up in the heat of things. So down the road, they picked up Ratliff and Hill, and they tooled around for a little while until they found a pasture to hide out in and hung out there all day. Carl Wiley was with them the whole time and later told the authorities that the robbers had two or three shotguns, a rifle, many pistols, and a sack of ammunition. That night, after resting all day, they continued driving around, avoiding the cops and returning to Cisco in an attempt to hide in plain sight. They ditched Wiley and his car, telling him that they could have killed him if they wanted to, but they didn't. They shook hands with Wiley, stole another car, and took off. Wiley immediately ran to the police station and reported what had happened over the last 24 hours. And in no time, police officers were mobilized to look for the robbers, knowing that they were in town. A few hours later, an officer in South Bend saw a roadster driving with one tire missing, just driving on the rim. And he was like, "Well, that's not normal." And the people in the roadster saw that they were spotted, so they backed up and drove the other way. The officer immediately called for a group of officers to follow, and two police cars took off in pursuit of the criminals. In the second car was highly decorated and celebrated Texas Ranger Cy Bradford. The police chased them for a while with the robbers shooting out the windows at the police, and they chased them to an oil field where the robbers' car came to a stop and Ratliff, Helms, and Hill jumped out and started running. Texas Ranger Cy Bradford jumped out of his car before it even stopped moving and ran a diagonal flank to cut them off, lowering his shotgun and fired at Ratliff, who went down and didn't get back up. He then lowered his shotgun and hit Helms, who had somehow gone unscathed until now. But he was able to get back up and stagger on. Hill was also shot, but both Hill and Helms were able to make it to the brush and escape into the woods. Cy went back to Marshal Ratliff, who was down on the ground, wounded but alive. He had five automatics, three cartridge belts, and a shotgun, the largest arsenal any bandit had ever carried on him in the history of crime in the United States to that point. He was immediately arrested and brought in. But that left the two other bandits, Helms and Hill, who were still on the run. And after what was coined the Battle of South Bend, the greatest manhunt in West Texas history began. There were dozens of sheriffs, Texas Rangers, bloodhounds were put on the trail, hundreds of citizens joined the search, and for the first time in history, an airplane was used for an overhead bird's eye view of the search. At one point, a member of the posse stood on top of a big boulder under which Helms and Hill both crouched, but they were never seen. Helms and Hill wandered around aimlessly, delirious from a loss of blood, and they stole a few ears of corn from a barn that they crashed at for the night. And by the next morning, after a little more rambling around, they realized that they had wandered back to where they started. Finally, they made it to Graham, Texas, where a civilian saw them and notified the authorities. They were cornered by deputies Gentry Williamson and E.H. Little and City Marshal J.W. Davis. I tell you, they loved their initials back then. Both Hill and Helms feebly made attempts to escape, but the jig was up. And the manhunt ended Friday, December 30th, exactly 1 week after the robbery, with two officers and one bandit killed, six citizens and three bandits wounded, three bandits arrested, making the Cisco holdup the most sensational crime in the state of Texas in the past 25 years. Ratliff was the first one to recover from his wounds and was put on trial only a few weeks after the crime. And even though no one could identify him at the bank because he was wearing a Santa suit, there was the eyewitness of the little girl who saw him pull down his beard in the car during the escape. This was enough to convict him and sentence him to 99 years, to which he said to police officers, "That is no hill for a high stepper like me." A couple weeks later, he was tried and convicted for murder of Sheriff Bedford and was sentenced to the electric chair. Not so cocky now, are you, Marshall? Helms was the next to be tried and convicted of the death of Deputy Carmichael and was sentenced to death by Old Sparky, which I didn't know was a nickname given to electric chairs in Arkansas, Connecticut, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Kentucky, Nebraska, New York, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Texas, Virginia, and West Virginia. The one in Texas was built in 1924 by prisoners, which is kind of messed up, and it was retired in 1964 and is now on public display as part of a replica death chamber at the Texas Prison Museum in Huntsville, Texas. Helms was executed on September 6, 1929. His last meal was cabbage, sausage, tomatoes, coffee, and pie. I feel like he could have done better than that, but what do I know? Helms was dragged, kicking and screaming, to the electric chair while his friend Ratliff watched from his cell. Ratliff had been given a portable phonograph a few months earlier, and as murderers were sent to the chair, he would play "When the Roll Is Called Up Yonder," an 1893 Christian hymn by James Milton Black. But on the day of Helms' execution, the phonograph was silent. Robert Hill pleaded guilty and was given a sentence of 99 years. He professed to his lawyer that he would be a model prisoner and said that he wanted to be baptized. However, shortly after his imprisonment, he tried to escape and was caught a couple hours later. He escaped two more times after that, once for a couple weeks, and was caught both times. Soon he calmed down and did his time and was pardoned in the 40s. He changed his name, became a productive member of society. That just leaves Marshall Ratliff. After his conviction and sentenced to death by the electric chair, he appealed it month after month, but was always rejected. So after that, his lawyer filed an insanity plea, and he was moved from Huntsville Penitentiary to the Eastland County Jail, and for 10 days, he pretended to be blind, paralyzed, and have dementia. The officers had to feed him, bathe him, carry him to the bathroom, and all that stuff, and when the officers had let down their guard on November 18, 1929, as officers Pat Kilborn and Deputy Sheriff Tom Jones were locking cells up on the other side of the station, Ratliff snuck out of his cell and went up to the office and took Jones' gun. But the keys to the front door weren't there, so he had to make his way back to his cell. But on the way back, he ran into Deputy Jones, and without even thinking, he shot Jones three times. Pat Kilborn, at that point, lunged for Ratliff, grabbed the gun that was now empty, and pistol-whipped Ratliff multiple times. Jones was rushed to the hospital. And when the townspeople had heard about Sheriff Jones, who was affectionately known as Uncle Tom, they were outraged. And an angry mob of 1,000 people stormed the jail property, yelling, "Bring him over here, and we've waited long enough!" And Kilborn was like, "Please, people, go home. Ratliff will face justice for what he has done the legal way. We are better than this." And the angry mob was like, "Oh, we are not." And they broke into the jail, grabbed Ratliff, stripped him naked, and dragged him 200 feet from the jail to a telephone pole where someone had thrown a rope over the crossbeam and started stringing him up. But the rope was not strong and it snapped, and Ratliff fell back to the ground. But the mob grabbed him and held on to him while someone grabbed another rope. Finally, they were ready to hang him again, and someone allowed him to speak. His last words were, "Boys, forgive me." And he was then raised up and hanged, and his lifeless body was left there for a half hour until the sheriff ordered him cut down. Marshall Ratliff, the Santa Claus Bandit, died at 9:55 p.m. on November 19, 1929. The next morning, Deputy Sheriff Tom Jones died in the hospital with loved ones surrounding him. He died knowing that the man who had killed him had been killed himself. So that's it. That's the story of the Santa Claus Bandit and the Santa Claus Bank Robbery of 1927. I mean, if that doesn't put you into the holiday spirit, I don't know anything, right? So thank you very much for joining me and listening to this Christmas special. I really appreciate it. I hope you're having a great time today with your family. If you're not listening to this on Christmas Day, I do not blame you. You probably got better things to do, but it's here. It is here for you if you just want to get away from your family and listen to something for about a half hour. So again, a Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, all that good stuff. And we will be back next week with a pirate, I'm thinking. And we're going to, I don't know, maybe there's some sort of New Year's theme we can do. Either way, we're going to be back. So until then, I hope you have a great week, and I will talk to you later.